Some spots on a map just hum with untold stories, don't they?
They really do.
For me, Mount Lulun in the Afrin region of northwestern Syria, right up against the Turkish border, is definitely one of those places. It's not just a geographical marker. It feels like the landscape itself is, well, whispering centuries of history, culture, and strategic importance.
It really is. And for this deep dive, the material you've gathered is fantastic. We've got historical documents that give us that crucial long-term perspective, archaeological reports that let us almost touch the past, and contemporary analyses that bring us right up to the present. Our aim, really, is to understand what makes Mount Lulun so significant, why this particular mountain holds such weight in the region's story.
Absolutely. And even the different names it's known by tell a fascinating story in themselves. You hear Kurd Dagh, Sheikh Kremenk, Jabal al-Akrad.
Right. All Kurdish links.
All clearly linking it to its historical Kurdish population. But then the official names shift to Jabal al-Aruba, even Mount Aleppo, and more recently, the local people apparently call it Jabal Alam, the Mountain of Dreams.
Which is quite poignant.
It speaks to this constant interplay of identity and control over the land, doesn't it?
Exactly. Those names are like layers of history written right on top of each other,
Yes.
reflecting different eras and the agendas of whoever was in power.
So in this deep dive, we're going to try and unpack all of that.
Yeah, let's do it. We'll start by getting a real sense of the physical mountain, the geography, then dig into the ancient past through archaeology, trace its path through various empires, explore its vital role in Kurdish identity, and its surprisingly diverse religious landscape. Maybe even touch on some local folklore if we can find hints.
And the present day, of course.
And finally, yeah, look at its current reality, which is unfortunately shaped by ongoing conflict. It's a journey through time and across cultures, all focused on this one fascinating place.
Okay, let's picture it then. What does Mount Lulun actually look like on the ground? What's the terrain?
Geographically, Mount Lulun is part of that larger limestone massif in northwestern Syria. It's often considered part of the Mount Simian Range. Think of it as more of a plateau or maybe a low mountain range, compared to some of the taller peaks in the broader Kurd-Dagh system to the west. Those are basaltic grays alone. Lulun's elevations are more moderate.
Okay, so how high are we talking?
On average, around 500 to 550 meters. The highest point is Sheikh Barakat Peak, which gets up to about 870 meters.
So not towering mountains, but still a definite presence.
Definitely a prominent feature in the landscape, yeah.
You mentioned limestone. How has that shaped the terrain? I imagine caves and things.
In a big way. Yeah, the limestone geology has created what we call karst topography.
Right, gosh.
Think of it as a landscape sculpted by water dissolving the rock over, vast periods. This leads to the formation of caves, like the Duderi Cave,
Ah, yes, Duderi.
which remarkably has evidence of Neanderthal habitation from tens of thousands of years ago.
Incredible.
That gives you a sense of the deep, deep history here. You also get features like the Jelikef Sor, which translates to the Red Cave Valley, and those really interesting sort of etched and grooved rock surfaces called lappes.
Lapis, okay.
Geologically, the mountain itself is essentially an uplifted block defined by fault lines in the Earth's crust.
And how do the slopes around Mount Lulun differ? Is it steep all around?
No, there's a clear contrast, actually. The western side tends to be quite steep. You get these escarpments that drop down towards the Afrin River Valley and the Nahr al-Aswad, the Black River. But on the eastern side, the slopes are much more gradual. They sort of melt into the Aleppo Plateau.
Makes sense.
And the entire area is crisscrossed by wadis, those dry riverbeds that fill up with water when it rains.
Right, seasonal rivers, and of course, water is always critical. What about permanent rivers and springs?
Absolutely vital. Mount Lulun is quite close to the Afrin River itself, which flows down from Turkey and is a major water source for the whole region. And the fertile Kume Plain borders Lulun, particularly to the north and west, making it a pretty productive agricultural area. Interestingly, the western base of the mountain, near those steep slopes, is dotted with numerous springs places with names like Basuta, Gazoia, Ain Dara, Taranda.
So that's where settlements would likely cluster.
Historically, yes. These springs have been incredibly important for settlements and agriculture, especially in a region that can be quite dry for parts of the year.
Which naturally leads us to the climate. What kind of weather does Mount Lulun typically experience?
It's a classic Mediterranean climate, much like you'd find, around the Mediterranean Sea.
Predictable enough.
So hot, dry summers and cool, wet winters. Most of the rain falls between September and May, roughly.
And how much rain? Enough for farming.
The average annual rainfall is in that 400 to 550 millimeter range. According to the sources, that's generally sufficient for decent agriculture in Syria, especially with those springs. They also get seasonal winds, mainly from the northwest during the summer. And something to keep in mind is that winter can bring some pretty cold air masses.
Ah.
Yeah, leading to occasional severe frosts that can really damage sensitive crops, like olive and pomegranate trees.
Olives being really significant there, right? I keep reading about the olives.
Hugely significant. Historically, parts of Mount Lelin were quite well forested with species typical of a Mediterranean environment. Oak, pine, wild olive, terebinth, hawthorn, sumac.
A real mix.
Yeah. And there were even mentions in the sources of sacred groves, like the Kemar Forest and another one near Kafr Nabu, associated with a local shrine.
Interesting, that connection between nature and belief.
Definitely. The undergrowth included things like thyme and chamomile.
Yeah.
But yes, olive trees are incredibly important, both economically and culturally.
And the soil's good for them.
Apparently so. The reddish soils on the mountain are quite well suited for olive cultivation, along with other crops like cereals, figs, and grapes. And traditionally, pastoralism raising sheep and cattle has also been a significant part of the local economy.
Sadly, I know things have taken a turn for the worse regarding the vegetation recently.
It's a really tragic situation, yeah. Since the 2018 occupation, there have been widespread reports of extensive deforestation and illegal logging across the Afrin region, and Mount Lelin hasn't been spared.
Just cutting down trees.
Cutting down forests, including, heartbreakingly, ancient olive trees. Often for timber or charcoal. It has a devastating impact on the local economy, the environment, and, well, the very character of the cultural landscape.
It's awful to think about the long-term damage. Now, shifting focus slightly, we touched on it earlier, but the strategic importance of this terrain seems undeniable. Why is Mount Lelin so strategically valuable?
Well, its geography gives it some inherent advantages. As we mentioned, the elevated terrain offers commanding views over the crucial surrounding plains. The Kumeh Plain, the Azaz Plains, and the approaches to Aleppo.
Always a key city.
Always. So it's a natural spot for observation and defense, controlling movement between the coast and the Syrian interior. The Romans clearly recognized this.
They built a base there.
A significant military base at Cyrus, right on its northeastern edge. Historically, it often sat on the frontier between major powers, like the Byzantine Empire and various Muslim caliphates. Locals have even described it as a natural fortress.
And that strategic value hasn't lessened in more recent times, has it? I mean, with the current conflict.
Not at all, no. In the Syrian civil war, control of Mount Lelin's peaks became a key military objective during Turkey's Operation Olive Branch in 2018.
Right.
Securing high ground like Mount Barsaya, which is right next to Lelin, was critical and saw some really intense fighting.
So it's still very much contested ground.
Very much so. More recently, the mountain, particularly the area known now as Jabal al-Alam, acts as a significant demarcation line between different controlling forces. And the construction of new settlements on its slopes suggests an ongoing effort to, well, solidify control over this strategically vital terrain.
It just keeps playing a role.
Its geography continues to play a major role in the military and political realities of northern Syria. Absolutely.
It really underscores how the physical shape of the land can dictate the course of human events. Let's delve deeper into that human history now, going way back to the earliest settlements. What does archaeology tell us about the ancient past of Mount Lelin and the surrounding area?
The archaeological record reveals a very, very long history of human presence. We have that Paleolithic evidence, those Neanderthal remains found in the Duderi Cave.
Tens of thousands of years ago.
Exactly, pushing the timeline way back. In the wider Afrin region, there's evidence of Neolithic settlements too, you know, marking the shift to agriculture and more settled ways of life.
Right, the farming revolution.
Then during the Bronze and Iron Ages, the area was definitely within the sphere of influence of major Near Eastern powers. Think Aluk, the Hurrians, Mitanni, the Hittites.
Big names.
Yeah, and the discovery of the Afrin stele is quite cool. It has a Luwian inscription.
Luwian.
An ancient Anatolian language. It dates to the 9th or 8th century BC, giving us a tangible link to the Saro-Hittite culture of that time.
Fascinating.
Later, of course, the region came under the control of successive empires, Neo-Assyrian, Neo-Babylonian, Persian, and then the Seleucids after Alexander. It was truly a crossroads.
A real crossroads of civilizations. And Mount Lelin itself seems to be home to some really significant archaeological sites. Let's talk about some of the key ones. You mentioned Ayn Dara.
Yes, Ayn Dara. It's located south of Afrin City. It's a remarkable Iron Age Syro-Hittite temple complex dating roughly 1300 to 740 BC.
What's special about it?
Well, it's particularly famous for its distinctive architecture, the intricate basalt reliefs that adorned its walls, and those colossal carved footprints at the entrance.
Footprint?
Yeah, huge footprints carved into the stone. Some scholars believe they might represent a deity, maybe marking their presence.
Wow.
Sadly, this incredibly important site suffered significant damage from shelling during the 2018 operations.
Oh, that's terrible. An irreplaceable loss. What about Siris, which is also known as Nabihuri?
Siris, yeah. It's situated northeast of Afrin, near the Turkish border. Mm-hmm. It was a major urban center that really rose to prominence during the Seleucid period.
After Alexander.
Right. The Romans, as we said, recognized its strategic value and turned it into a key military base. It also became the administrative center of the region known as Syrestica.
And crystal history, too.
Very much so. By the 4th century AD, it had become an important Christian center with its own bishop. Archaeologically, we can still see impressive remains, a Roman theater, temples, fortifications, and evidence of significant Christian structures. Possibly churches dedicated to Saints Cosmas and Damian, maybe even the tomb of Saint Simeon the Younger.
So it had multiple names.
It had its Greek name, Siris, and later, reflecting its Christian importance, it was also known as Hagiopolis, which means City of Saints.
Fitting, but I guess it's also faced problems recently.
Unfortunately, yes. There have been reports of looting at the site since 2018, which is deeply concerning for preserving this history.
It's a disturbing pattern we're seeing. Now, call it Simon, the monastery of St. Simeon Stylites. That's truly iconic, isn't it? Even if it's technically just on the edge of the larger Jabal Simon range, which includes Laloon.
Absolutely iconic. It's an integral part of the region's heritage and its historical narrative. This vast 5th century Byzantine pilgrimage complex. It's just stunning.
Built around the pillar.
Exactly. It grew up around the pillar of St. Simeon Stylites the Elder, that hugely influential figure in early Christian asceticism who famously spent decades living atop a series of pillars.
Incredible devotion or something.
Well, yes. The complex included 4 massive basilicas radiating out from the central base of his final pillar, along with a monastery, a baptistry, other buildings. It was huge.
A major destination.
Oh, absolutely. Later, during Islamic rule, it was fortified and became known as Qalat Simon, Simeon's Castle. It really speaks volumes about the immense religious significance this area held during the Byzantine era, drawing pilgrims from all over the Christian world.
And then we have this fascinating collection of what are known as the Dead Cities. Right. Several of those are located on or very near Mount Laloon itself, right?
Yes, Mount Laloon sits right within or at the northern edge of this remarkable area in the Limestone Hills, famous for these incredibly well-preserved late antique settlements.
Dead Cities sounds a bit morbid.
Yeah, it's a bit of a misnomer. They weren't necessarily dead in the sense of being forgotten, but rather abandoned settlements that offer an amazing snapshot of life in the late Roman and Byzantine periods.
Like time capsules.
Pretty much. Let's take Brad, or Barad.
Yeah.
It's a substantial Byzantine town located southwest of Qalat Simon, with ruins of several churches, tombs, houses, and what looks like some kind of public building, a testament to a thriving community.
And Kafr Nabu sounds particularly intriguing with its potential links to pre-Christian beliefs.
Kafr Nabu, yeah, that's near Brad. It has extensive ruins, suggesting a long and complex history. The name itself.
Nabu, like the god.
Exactly. It's led to speculation about a possible connection to the ancient Mesopotamian god, Nabu, the god of wisdom and writing, which could maybe indicate an earlier temple or shrine dedicated to him.
Fascinating if true.
Later, it became a significant Christian site with multiple churches. One remarkably dates back to 398 AD.
Wow, that's early.
Making it one of the oldest known churches in the entire region, and another from 525 AD. There's also a monastery tower, a big pilgrim hostel built around 504 AD, houses, and even an olive press dated way back to 224 AD.
So olives were important even then.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The medieval Arab geographer Yaqut al-Amawi even mentioned the supposed link to Nabu and a grand dome that once stood there. And adding to the mystery are these distinctive headless statues found near the church.
Headless statues. Strange.
And the nearby shrine of Sheikh Kassab is also historically linked to this area. It really makes you wonder about the layers of belief and practice that existed here over time.
It's incredible to think of all that history concentrated in one place. And Basufen is another of these dead cities located on Mount Laloon, isn't it?
Yes. Basufen is on the slopes of Mount Laloon, quite close to Qalat Simon, It contains well-preserved Byzantine ruins, a church, what looks like a market area, rock-cut tombs, cisterns for water, and several ancient olive presses.
More olive presses.
Again, highlighting the agricultural importance. It's also the site of the shrine of Sheikh Ali. Interestingly, in more recent times, Basufen was identified as a Yazidi village.
Ah, the Yazidi connection.
Yes, and it was sadly targeted in attacks back in 2015, even before the major 2018 invasion.
And beyond these major named sites, I assume there are just countless other smaller ruins scattered across Mount Lun.
Exactly. Numerous smaller abandoned settlements, more modest ruins, more ancient presses. They all tell the story of a densely settled and agriculturally productive landscape, particularly during the Byzantine period. It suggests a thriving rural economy.
So, drawing all this archaeological evidence together, what does it tell us about the overall significance of Mount Leilin in antiquity? What are the key insights?
Well, what we see is a picture of a region that was historically important, prosperous, and culturally vibrant for millennia.
Clearly not some remote backwater.
Not at all. The evidence shows continuity from the Syro-Hittite period right through the Hellenistic, Roman, and especially the Byzantine eras. That's when it really flourished.
The churches and monasteries really stand out.
The sheer number of religious structures, mm-hmm. churches, monasteries, pilgrimage sites like Kolat Simen, it underscores how deeply integrated it was into the religious, economic, and social fabric of Byzantine Syria.
And the olives again.
The widespread evidence of extensive olive cultivation emphasizes its agricultural wealth and its role in the regional economy.
Oh.
And those possible pre-Christian traces, like the Nabu connection to Kafr Nabu, they hint at fascinating processes of religious change and maybe syncretism, the blending of different beliefs. It was clearly a central area within the dynamic civilizations of the ancient and late antique Near East.
And the later abandonment of many sites is still a puzzle.
Yeah, why so many of these thriving towns were eventually abandoned after the Byzantine era.
Yeah.
That's a major historical question scholars are still working on.
Absolutely. Now, let's move through time. What happened in the eras after the Roman and Byzantine periods, early Islamic period, and beyond?
Okay, so following the Muslim conquests in the 7th century AD, the region became part of the Jin Qanisrin, an administrative district within the early Islamic caliphates.
How did things change initially?
The initial period under Islamic rule seems to have been relatively stable, actually. One particularly interesting point from the historical records is the reported resettlement of a group known as the Jarajima.
Jarajima?
Yeah, some scholars think they might have been related to the early Maronite Christians. They were reportedly resettled on a Mount Lulun and the nearby Hawar Mountain around the year 707 AD.
Interesting. So people were still moving into the area.
It suggests the area was still seen as viable, maybe even desirable, even for groups with distinct identities. Later on, though, the region found itself caught in the crossfire of conflicts between the Byzantine Empire and various Muslim powers, particularly the Hamdanids based in Aleppo.
So battles and damage.
Seems likely. Some sources mention damage at sites like Kalat Simen during that period. Now, regarding the Kurds, the exact timeline is still debated by historians.
Okay.
But some sources suggest Kurdish tribes might have had an early presence, maybe as mercenaries initially. They were certainly more firmly established by the time of the Crusades in the 11th and 12th centuries.
So continuous habitation seems likely.
Yeah, it's likely habitation continued, although settlement patterns and the overall economy probably shifted over time. Eventually, the area came under the rule of the Mamluk Sultanate in the later Middle Ages.
And then came the long Ottoman era, centuries of rule. How did Mount Lulun fit into the Ottoman Empire?
With the Ottoman conquest of Syria around 1516, Mount Lulun became part of the vast Ottoman Empire. It fell within the Vilayet, or province of Aleppo, and was under the administrative jurisdiction of Kilis, a nearby town.
And this is when the Kurdish identity becomes more prominent.
This period definitely saw the consolidation and increasing prominence of the Kurdish population. It's during this time that the name Kurda, meaning Mountain of the Kurds, became firmly and widely established for this area.
Right, Kurda.
Various Kurdish tribal groups were active. Locally, the Jambulat family, who were Kurdish, rose to significant power in the Aleppo and Kilis areas, wielding considerable influence for a time.
Any specific clans linked to Mount Lulun itself?
Yes. Historical records mention the settlement of specific Kurdish clans like the Robari in villages on the mountain, particularly in areas like Jalbul. Other clans like the Baslahaya and Abin are also mentioned.
And Yazidis too.
We also have confirmed records of Yazidi Kurds in the mountains dating back to at least 1599. So Yazidi presence for centuries. The town of Afrin itself started to emerge as a significant market center in the 19th century, really solidifying the region's character as a predominantly Kurdish-inhabited area within the Ottoman Empire.
And the 20th century brought really dramatic shifts with the collapse of the Ottoman Empire and the French Mandate. That must have had a huge impact.
Huge, absolutely. The end of World War I, the Ottoman collapse, the establishment of French mandatory rule over Syria, it fundamentally changed things for Afrin and Mount Lulun.
The borders were key, right?
The drawing of the Syria-Turkey border in 1923 was particularly significant. It cut Afrin off from its historical links to Kilis and the northern parts of the Kurd Dag that ended up in Turkey.
Isolated it in a way.
Exactly. The area became part of French-mandated Syria and eventually the independent Syrian Republic in 1946. Then, the annexation of Hatay province by Turkey in 1939 further isolated Afrin within Syria.
And then, under independent Syria, especially with the Ba'ath regime.
As a predominantly Kurdish area within Syria, it was subjected to various assimilationist policies, particularly under the Ba'ath regime from 1963 onwards. These policies, often called Arabization.
What did that involve?
It included changing Kurdish place names to Arabic ones, including the mountain itself in official contexts. Plus, restrictions on using the Kurdish language, expressing Kurdish culture, limitations on property rights for Kurds.
So a lot of pressure.
Significant pressure. Despite all that, the Afrin region, including Mount Lulun, maintained its status as a major center of Kurdish population and culture within Syria. But it also experienced periods of political unrest related to Kurdish national aspirations and grievances. These external borders and state policies really shaped the modern experience there.
It really sets the stage for the contemporary era, which we'll definitely need to discuss. But before we get there, let's explore the cultural and religious heart of Mount Lulun. It sounds like it's been a real meeting point.
It really has. Beyond its strong Kurdish identity, Mount Lulun boasts a rich and remarkably diverse religious history. It's a landscape where different faiths have left their mark over millennia.
A palimpsest, almost.
A perfect word for it. You have those potential echoes of pre-Abrahamic beliefs with the Nabu connection to Kafr Nabu. Then, as the archaeology shows so clearly, that extraordinary flourishing of Christianity during the Roman and Byzantine periods.
With Khalet Simon as the superstar.
Right. Major monastic centers, numerous churches, bishoprics. And the region has also been home to significant Yazidi communities for centuries. Specific villages on or near Mount Lulun, like Bisufan and Baye, were known Yazidi centers.
So Christianity, Yazidism, and Islam.
And of course, Islam arrived with the Arab conquests in the 7th century. Its presence is felt through historical administration and the veneration of local saints at numerous shrines, ziyarat or mazar.
Like Sheikh Barakat on the Peak.
Exactly. Sheikh Barakat on the Peak of Jabal Saman Lulun, Sheikh Ali in Basafan, Sheikh Kassab near Kafr Nabu. These shrines likely represent local Sufi traditions within Islam.
What strikes me is the proximity of all these different sites.
That's what's fascinating. You might find ruins of ancient churches not far from existing Yazidi villages or Christian ruins near important Muslim shrines. It really illustrates a long history of religious encounter. And, you know, at times, a degree of coexistence.
While coexistence now under threat, sadly.
Very much so. Sadly, this pluralistic heritage is now under severe threat due to the post-2018 occupation. Minority religious groups face intimidation, displacement, and restrictions on their practices. It's a tragic turn.
And it's not just about the formal religious structures, is it? The landscape itself seems to hold a deep layer of sacred significance.
Absolutely. That's a key point.
Yeah.
Beyond the constructed sites, specific natural features likely held and maybe still hold sacred connotations.
Mm-hmm.
Prominent peaks like Sheikh Barakat.
They often become special places.
Exactly. Natural features like springs, caves like Duderi, distinctive rock formations. They can become places of reverence or feature in local folklore.
Yeah.
And those sacred groves we mentioned at Sheikh Kassab and Kiamar Forest, they represent this profound interaction between the natural world and religious belief. So the mountain itself becomes a kind of sacred geography, imbued with layers of spiritual meaning inscribed right into the land.
Which naturally leads us to the whispers of the mountain, the mythology, and folklore. You mentioned earlier that finding explicit documented myths can be challenging. But what potential layers are there? What hints do we have?
Yeah, while we might not have, grand defined mythologies like Greek myths, Mount Lulun's story is certainly interwoven with threads of folklore and local traditions.
Like the name itself.
Even the name Lunan has competing possible origins. One links it to the Mesopotamian god Nabu.
Wisdom in writing.
Perhaps suggesting ancient associations there. Another links it to the Kurdish word for unripe olives, connecting it to nature, fertility, agriculture.
Different memories embedded in the name.
Could be. Different cultural memories or folk explanations. The potential Nabu temple at Kafr Nabu, if real, would tie the mountain to ancient Near Eastern mythologies and that idea of religious syncretism.
And the saints, like Simeon Stylites.
Religious figures like Saint Simeon the Elder undoubtedly became subjects of local legends and miracle stories, going beyond just the historical facts. And those numerous local shrines, Sheikh Barakat, Sheikh Ali, Sheikh Asab.
They must have stories attached.
Almost certainly. Associated with rich oral traditions, miracle stories, foundation legends explaining how they started, specific rituals passed down through generations.
So why the difficulty in finding more explicit myths? Is it just not recorded?
Several reasons, probably. Oral traditions are, well, oral. They're vulnerable to being lost. One source even mentioned relying on elders' memories while also noting potential inaccuracies.
Right.
And in recent times, the intense focus on the political situations, conflict, the human rights crisis, it may have overshadowed efforts to systematically record local folklore.
Understandable, but sad.
And tragically, the massive displacement since 2018 that disrupts communities and poses a huge threat to passing down these oral traditions.
So the knowledge itself is being displaced.
Exactly. So the scarcity of detailed myths might be due to the types of sources prioritized, research difficulties in a conflict zone, or just the cultural disruption. Maybe the mythology isn't in grand narratives, but embedded in interpreting the sacred landscape, the stories of sites, and the collective memory of Kurdish identity, especially under pressure.
And new myths might be forming now.
It's possible. In the current context, modern political agendas could be driving new forms of myth-making around identity, ownership, and the naming of the land itself.
It's a poignant reminder of how much intangible cultural heritage can be at risk. Let's turn now to Mount Lunan in the contemporary era, which, as we know, has been marked by really significant and often tragic events. What was the situation like in the years leading up to 2018, before the Turkish operation?
Okay. So after Syrian government forces withdrew from many Kurdish areas in 2012, as the civil war ramped up, control of the Afrin region, including Mount Lunan, largely fell to the Kurdish People's Protection Units, the YPG.
Part of the autonomous administration.
Yes. In January 2014, Afrin was declared a canton within the self-proclaimed Autonomous Administration of North and East Syria, ANS, or Rojava, as it's often called.
And was it stable then?
Compared to many other parts of Syria during that incredibly volatile period, Afrin experienced a relative degree of stability and security. It actually became a refuge.
People fled there.
Yeah, there was an influx of internally displaced people seeking safety there, escaping intense fighting elsewhere. However, it wasn't entirely peaceful.
Facing attacks.
It faced occasional shelling and attacks from Turkish forces and various Syrian rebel groups who opposed the YPG. There was even a brief Russian military presence for a time. But generally, the ANS set up its own administration and maintained security within Afrin.
And then came Turkey's Operation Olive Branch in early 2018. What were the stated reasons behind that?
Turkey launched Operation Olive Branch in January 2018. The publicly stated aim was to counter the influence of the YPG.
Because Turkey links the YPG to the PKK.
Exactly. Ankara views the YPG as an extension of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK, which Turkey designates as a terrorist organization. The Turkish government saw the Kurdish-led autonomous region on its southern border as a major national security threat.
And they objected to U.S. support for Kurdish forces elsewhere.
Strongly objected to U.S. support for the Syrian Democratic Forces, the SDF, in other parts of Syria because the SDF is dominated by the YPG.
It was a major military operation, wasn't it? Heavy fighting.
Oh, yes, a large-scale offensive, intense aerial bombardment by the Turkish Air Force, and a ground invasion by Turkish troops and the Syrian National Army, the SNA.
The Turkish-backed Syrian groups.
Right, a coalition of Syrian opposition groups supported by Turkey. There was fierce fighting, especially for strategic high ground. Mount Barsaya, right next to Lulun, was heavily contested.
And the Russians left it beforehand.
Reports indicated a withdrawal of Russian military personnel shortly before the operation began. By mid-March 2018, Afrin City fell. And by the end of March, the entire Afrin region, including Mount Lulun, was under Turkish and SNA control.
And the consequences of that occupation, They've been really far-reaching and deeply concerning, haven't they, based on the reports?
Absolutely. The 2018 invasion and the occupation since then have fundamentally altered the reality for Mount Lulun and all of Afrin.
How so? What changed on the ground?
Well, the Kurdish-led administration was dismantled, replaced by Turkish-backed local councils, often staffed by people from outside Afrin. Control on the ground became quite fragmented among different SNA factions, leading to a chaotic, often dangerous environment.
And the people, the demographic changes.
We've seen mass displacement. Hundreds of thousands of Kurds and others fled their homes. This resulted in a dramatic ongoing shift in the region's demography.
And resettlement.
Alongside the displacement, there's been a systematic policy of resettling displaced Sunni Arabs from other parts of Syria and families of SNA fighters into the homes and onto the lands of those who fled or were forced out.
Including new settlements, even on Mount Lulun.
Yes, including the construction of new settlements on confiscated land, including on Mount Lulun itself, in the area renamed Jabal al-Alam.
And human rights violations. The UN has reported on this, right?
Numerous human rights organizations and the UN have documented widespread violations. Things like arbitrary arrests and detentions, often just for alleged affiliation with the former ANEs. Credible reports of torture, ill-treatment, enforced disappearances, extrajudicial killings, kidnappings for ransom.
A climate of fear.
A pervasive climate of fear, yeah.
Huh.
And a lack of accountability for abuses against the remaining Kurdish population and other minorities. Gender-based violence is also frequently reported.
The reports of systematic property confiscation are particularly disturbing. That seems designed to prevent people from ever returning.
They are deeply disturbing and do have profound long-term consequences. There's been widespread, systematic seizure of private property, homes, shops, farmland, and especially those vital olive groves.
Belonging to Kurds and Yazidis, mainly.
Primarily belonging to displaced or remaining Kurds and other minorities like the Yazidis. This property is often redistributed to SNA fighters' families, rented to new settlers, or converted to military bases.
And the money funds the factions.
Sometimes. Yes. The revenues are sometimes used to fund the factions. It's systematic dispossession, further altering the demographics and undermining the original population's economic base.
And alongside this, we hear about cultural and environmental destruction. The archaeology, the forests.
Yes, the cultural and environmental heritage has also suffered significantly. Documented damage to important archaeological sites like Ain Dara, numerous reports of looting and illegal digging at other heritage sites.
Targeting minorities, too.
Minority religious sites, particularly Yazidi shrines and properties, have been targeted for vandalism and destruction. And then there's the large-scale, often illegal logging of forests, including those ancient olive groves.
Which is economic, environmental, and cultural loss all at once.
Exactly. It's a catastrophe on multiple levels. Plus, reports of intimidation and restrictions on minority religious practices add ongoing security instability from infighting between SNA factions. The post-2018 reality is one of coercive transformation.
Altering everything.
Altering demography, society, economy, culture. Replacing Kurdish self-rule with violations and demographic shifts. It's a grim picture painted by the sources.
Despite all this turmoil, Mount Lulun continues to hold strategic importance, doesn't it? It's still a key location.
It absolutely does. It remains a highly contested frontier zone. It effectively separates areas under Turkish SNA control from those held by the Syrian government, Russian forces, and the SDF.
So its location still matters militarily.
Its commanding terrain is still a valuable military asset. Control over it remains crucial for Turkey's broader strategic objectives in northern Syria. Buffer zones, refugee management, regional influence, it's still very much in play.
It paints a really sobering and complex picture. A region with such deep, rich history now facing immense challenges. So, as we bring this deep dive to a close, what are the absolute key takeaways about the significance of Mount Lulun that we should keep in mind?
I think ultimately Mount Lulun is far more than just a physical location on a map. It's a geographical area with historical roots stretching back to the very beginnings of settled human life.
Millennia of history.
Right. It has served as a central, deeply significant place for Kurdish identity in Syria for centuries. Its landscape has been a meeting point for a remarkable diversity of religious traditions, often coexisting in really intricate ways.
And there's more to uncover.
It holds potential for uncovering even more about the region's rich folklore and cultural heritage. And tragically, in our current era, it's become a focal point of intense conflict and a site of profound, often forced, transformation.
It truly stands as a living testament, doesn't it? To the intricate interplay of history, culture, and the ever-present dynamics of power. It really makes you consider just how deeply the physical landscape is intertwined with the human stories that unfold upon it, for better and often for worse.
Precisely. And when we consider this incredibly layered history and the immense cultural significance of Mount Laloon, it leads to a really crucial and perhaps uncomfortable question for us all to ponder.
Which is?
What will be the long-term consequences of the ongoing demographic changes and the documented cultural destruction for the region and its people? It's a question that deserves continued attention and further exploration as we try to understand the enduring impact of these really significant and troubling events.